นะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะนะโมตัสสะภะคะวะโตอะระหะโตสัมมาสัมพุทธัสสะบุตังธัมมังสังฆังนะมัสสามิครับโอเค so today is the Satipatthana Sutta number 10 in the Majjhima Nikaya and what do you find about this sutta? I'm just going to give a little bit of introduction before I start off actually reading the sutta and discussing it in detail. What you find about this sutta is that there is so much commentary, so many books out there written on the Satipatthana Sutta. You find manuals that are 300 pages, 400 pages long describing the sutta. And very often people say things like, oh, this is the most important sutta in the Pali Canon. You hear people in many countries that will recite the Satipatthana Sutta just as if it is some kind of sacred text almost. The reality is that although all these things are being said, there's nothing in the canon itself, in the Pali texts, that say that the Satipatthana Sutta is special or different from all the rest of the texts. It's neither more nor less important than anything else according to the rest of the Pali canon. That is an important thing to keep in mind, because sometimes these things get taken completely out of proportion. And one of the problems with understanding the Satipatthana Sutta is that often what people do, they take the Satipatthana Sutta on its own. They don't look at the context, they don't understand Satipatthana in the bigger picture of things. And when you take anything of the Dhamma as standing alone, as being something which is in its own right, is like the complete teaching, without actually looking at how it actually works in context, you're always very likely to make mistakes, because everything in the Dhamma is contextual. Everything is part of a greater network. It's like a matrix of things coming together. If you don't understand that matrix, if you don't understand the idea of causality in Buddhism, how one thing leads to another one, you're going to make a lot of mistakes understanding how the Dhamma actually works. So sometimes I say that Dhamma is like a puzzle. It's like a jigsaw puzzle, where you have all these different pieces, and you can only understand the whole picture when you have all the pieces fitted right together. An individual piece will never show you how the whole thing actually works. And another thing about the Satipatthana Sutta, which makes this so important, is that if you compare it, there are many different versions of the sutta. And if you compare all the different versions, you find they actually diverge quite a lot. They're not exactly the same. And why? How can that be the case? And the reason, obviously, must be that either some of those suttas, things have been taken away, or something has been added. And usually, you can assume that things have been added rather than taken away, because it's more likely that people would add things than take them away, simply because of the veneration to the suttas. That's at least my understanding of these things. So because of that, because the sutta itself seems to be a conglomerate where things have been added over time, and it's a very easy sutta to add things to, because it is a sutta which is divided up into very clear blocks, and each block is absolutely independent of the other ones. It's very easy to put in a block or remove a block, and nobody would be able to tell the difference, except if you compare it with other versions of the same sutta. And then you can see that something has happened. So there is a couple of Chinese versions of the sutta. There is one Mahayana version. There are versions, different versions in the Abhidhamma, and all of those versions are different in many ways. And of course, it's very interesting to ask why. And the answer usually is because things have been added over time. So this is important to keep in mind. And as I go through this, I will explain to you those things that may have been added. These things are always uncertain. You can never be absolutely sure how these things have developed. But I will point out those things that quite possibly, maybe even quite likely, have been added to the sutta at the very early stage as the suttas came into formation. But first of all, I want to talk about the context of Satipatthana outside of the Satipatthana Sutta, so just to have an understanding of the context of how Satipatthana actually works. And the context of Satipatthana is you find it in particular in the Noble Eightfold Path. And if you remember the Noble Eightfold Path, the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is right mindfulness, which is always defined as satipatthana. Now the Noble Eightfold Path, like all of these other groupings, like the seven bodhangas and the five indriyas, it's a gradual and causal path. So in other words, one factor leads to the next one. So in the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, you have right effort just before satipatthana. So right effort is a thing that leads you to satipatthana. After satipatthana, you have right concentration, which of course are the four jhanas. So the purpose from that point of view of satipatthana is to lead you to the four jhanas. So the purpose, if you look at the big picture, at the Noble Eightfold Path, is for satipatthana to take you to samadhi and the four jhanas. And it's not only the Noble Eightfold Path, it's also found in things like the five indriyas. In the five indriyas you have, again, before sati, you have, again, energy, virya, which again is similar to the effort in the Noble Eightfold Path. And afterwards, again, you have samadhi. Mindfulness, again, is found between energy, effort, and samadhi. It leads to samadhi, it comes from effort and energy. And it goes smoothly like that. And the more you read the suttas, and the more contexts that you understand and you see satipatthana in, the more you realize that this is a very recurrent and common theme in the suttas. There's a famous sutta, or at least it's famous for me, because I like the sutta, but it's called the Cook Sutta in the Sanghita Nikaya, in the Satipatthana Sanghita. And there, again, it's about the four satipatthanas. And the sutta says, if you practice the four satipatthanas correctly, what happens is that you abandon the upakilesas. Now, the upakilesas have many different meanings in the suttas, but sometimes it means like the refined hindrances of the mind. If you read the Upakilesa Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's a reference to the fine hindrances just before you get into samadhi. And that's what I take it to mean in this sutta as well. It seems very likely to mean that. So if you practice satipatthana correctly, it says, you abandon the upakilesas. And then it goes on to say how you enter the jhanas after that. That's one example. Another example is the Dantabhumi Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. Majjhima Nikaya, I think it's 125 or something like that. And again, it's the same thing. You practice the satipatthanas to overcome defilements, usually refined defilements, and after having overcome defilements, you enter jhana. Again, it's the same sequence again. And this is something you can find in many places. And this shows us that the main purpose of satipatthana in the suttas is to overcome the refined defilements. Of course, right effort is what overcomes the more coarser defilements. The very coarse ones are overcome by virtue, by right speech and right action. Right effort removes the next stage of coarse defilements in the mind. And then the most refined defilements are removed by satipatthana practice. And then it takes you on to jhana or to right samadhi. And this is the main purpose of satipatthana according to the suttas. It's very important to understand that, because you can only see that if you see the context of satipatthana, how it's used throughout. And then when you use that context, you use that and you think, you have that in the back of your mind when you read the Satipatthana Sutta, it makes an enormous difference in how you come to understand this particular sutta. So this means that the main purpose of satipatthana is to move you towards samadhi. It's not the only purpose, there is also vipassana in satipatthana, but that is its main purpose according to the suttas. A very important thing to keep in mind. The other thing which often comes up, which is very important to understand the context of satipatthana, how it actually works, is to remember when you read the Anapanasati Sutta, the main sutta in the canon on the mindfulness of breathing. You remember that one, it always says at the end of each quartet, each four, there's like 16 aspects to Anapanasati, and it's divided up into four, and so there's four factors in each one. At the end of each four factors, it says that when this quartet is practiced fully and completely, it leads to the fulfillment of satipatthana. And so it goes throughout the whole Anapanasati Sutta. So, by practicing Anapanasati, you are fulfilling the satipatthanas, all the way, all four satipatthanas. And that again is a very important statement, I think, because there is very little evidence in the suttas for how you should practice satipatthana. Sometimes it just says that you know that feelings are of this sort or feelings are of that sort. It doesn't give you any information about how you know that. Do you sit down and what do you actually do? The only place it actually says how you do that is in the Anapanasati Sutta, where it says that you understand the feelings as they arise while you do breath meditation. And that is the point. That is, it becomes very important because it is the only place that actually explains to you very clearly how this is to be done. Now, if you go to a Vipassana retreat, very often they will tell you to watch feelings in the body, for example. And I'm not saying that's wrong. It probably is valid to some extent, but it actually is never mentioned in the suttas that this is the way to contemplate feeling according to Satipatthana. The only way that is ever mentioned in the suttas is watching the breath and understanding the feelings that arise in the mind as a consequence of breath meditation. So I don't want to, there are probably many ways these things can be done, but I think it's also very useful to be clear about the way the suttas actually explain this, because then you have some context rather than just relying on what other teachers say. And sometimes these other teachers, they may get their ideas from all sorts of places, commentaries, Abhidhamma, and all kinds of things, and even later works. It's very hard to know sometimes where these ideas come from. And it's not that these ideas necessarily are wrong. That's not my point. My point is just that let's be clear on what the Buddha said, first of all, so that we know the context of these things. So that is just an overview for what Satipatthana is about. It is about overcoming the refined hindrances of the mind to attain samadhi. That's what it's all about. And then after that, it also has a vipassana thing. That actually comes later on, as I will show you as we go through this particular sutta. So that's just a little bit of an introduction for you to get us started. Once you know the context, you should see that we shall be able to unravel this sutta in much better detail to understand what it's all about. So now I will start reading the sutta itself. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus known as Kamasadamma. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied. The Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. So, this is like the introductory passage in the sutta. I would just like to explain to you what is happening here. First of all, it starts off by talking about this is the direct path. And if you have, I don't know if you are aware of this, but the Pali here is Ekayana, which literally means one going. So Ekayana Maggo is the one going path. And I think even direct path may not be the best translation. The point is that this is a path which goes in one direction only. It leads towards one direction. And that is what comes afterwards, the purification of beings. And sometimes this Ekayana has been translated very, in my opinion, very way off the mark in many places, particularly many years ago when people weren't so, in the West in particular, weren't so skilled yet in the Pali and understanding what was going on. It was translated sometimes as the one and only path, for example. And this is clearly not correct, because Ekayana is used in other places in the suttas to very clearly mean something which goes in one direction only. So the point of Satipatthana is that it leads you only in one direction. It leads you, in other words, towards the goal of the path, towards samadhi and towards all these kind of things. And what it leads to here is the purification of beings. And of course the idea of purification again is manifold. One aspect of that is the purification from defilements that you have to acquire before you can enter samadhi. That's the first one. And of course it also has a deeper aspect of total and complete purification. So here we seem to be dealing somehow a little bit of both of these aspects seem to be implied by this factor right here. And it says, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, and of course all of this is about the dukkha in the world, so the purpose of this is to eliminate dukkha. All of these things are standard expressions of suffering. For the attainment of the true way, the word for true way is nyaya, and basically this refers to like the Buddhist path, the Buddhist understanding of the world, how the world actually works. So what you are realizing here, what you are attaining here, is an understanding of the world, understanding of things, the true way things are, the nature of things, basically. And that nature of things is usually defined as dependent origination. And yaya, in many places in the suttas, is actually meant, what is meant is dependent origination. So what it leads to, in other words, satipatthana practice, eventually, is the understanding of dependent origination, which is, happens when you become a stream enterer. That's when you understand dependent origination for the first time. Because the first time that you get a full understanding of the Four Noble Truths and the full teaching of the Buddha. And finally, for the realization of Nibbana, which of course is arahatship. So you can see here all of these things are, there's a slight a gradualness here in the path. It starts with purifying yourself to attain samadhi, and then it talks about becoming a stream enterer and finally becoming an arahat. It's not perfectly delineated. It's a bit kind of a bit of many things happening here, but there is a many aspects which have a slight gradation to them anyway. And what are these four things? They are here called the four foundations of mindfulness. And I would say that the four foundations of mindfulness, I don't think it's a very good translation, to be honest. A foundation of mindfulness, to me, gives the impression that you do these things to become mindful. It's a foundation for mindfulness. You do it, you become mindful. That is not what this sutta is about. It's not about becoming mindful. In fact, I will show you just further down that you have to have mindfulness established already to be able to do satipatthana. So this is not about foundational mindfulness. What this is about is how you focus the mindfulness, where you place your mindfulness. So I like, Ajahn Brahm often translates this as the four focuses of mindfulness, the four places where you put your attention. And I think that is much more appropriate. Because remember that satipatthana has four things, four different aspects. The body, feelings, mind, and dhammas. We'll come to that afterwards. So you place your attention on these four different things. And that is what is meant by this thing. The four objects, if you like, of mindfulness. The four focuses, the four places where you put the attention. Why? Because mindfulness already needs to be established. The purpose of satipatthana is not to become mindful. That already has to be there before you can even start the practice. So that is the introductory passage there. If you have any questions, please, you can please ask as we go along. You're welcome to ask. And now comes the brief explanation of the four satipatthanas, which this is a kind of summary that you find throughout the suttas. So it's very useful to know how to understand this particular summary. What are the four? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind as mind, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So having read that, it's not very obvious necessarily what is meant by this. And there are a number of things here which are not very transparent and not very clear, and which need to be clarified to understand what's happening here. And the first one here you will see is that he abides contemplating the body as a body. And then next one is feelings as feeling, mind as mind. What does this mean? Contemplating the body as a body. And if you look at the commentaries will give you an explanation that what is meant is that you look at the body, all you see is the body. You don't make a self out of it. You don't add anything which isn't there. You just see the body as the body. That seems to be the main explanation that you find in the commentaries and the meaning of this. But I would say that a more likely understanding of this is found, again, if you turn to the Anapanasati Sutta. One of the principles that I use for understanding the suttas, if I can, I always use other explanation in the suttas to explain other places in the suttas. So in other words, I always try to cross-reference the suttas instead of taking definitions from outside. So if there is a contradiction between how the suttas explain something and the commentary say something, I prefer the sutta explanation over the commentary explanation. Sometimes they can just be complementary. There can be different ways of looking at it. But normally I would always talk about the sutta explanation first. And what you find if you turn to the Anapanasati Sutta, and there it says that the breath meditation is a body contemplation, and then it says why? Why is the breath meditation a body contemplation? And then it says, because the breath is one body among bodies. And this is the idea in Pali of body. This is the word kaya in Pali. It just means a conglomeration. It means like a mass of things which are unified into a body. Just like in English, we talk about a body of evidence, it means a mass of evidence collected together. Or you talk about a corporate body, which is like a whole company which has come together here. So the word body just means a mass of things come together here. So the breath is like all types of breath put together into one thing. This is the body of breaths, if you like. And then you have the physical body, and then you have the mental body, and all of these things can be called kaya in Pali. It's a very important thing to understand that kaya has all these diverse meanings, because it opens up new vistas in how you understand the Pali texts. So because of that, because the breath is called a body in there, and that is the explanation for a body as a body in the Anapanasati Sutta, I take the meaning of this to be he abides contemplating the body, or rather a body among bodies. A body among bodies is what I understand this thing as. So in other words, what that means is that there is all these different bodies you can contemplate. The physical body is what is usually meant here, but that physical body is composed of many things, and they are like sub-bodies within the main body. And then you can contemplate any of those sub-bodies. So you contemplate a body among bodies, or a body in the body. That, I think, for me, is the most natural meaning here. And that's why the breath, which is an aspect of the physical body, is itself called like a sub-body of the body itself. And this is how I understand all the contemplations down here. So if you contemplate feelings as feelings, what it actually means is that you contemplate certain feelings among all possible feelings. The mind as mind is a contemplation of certain aspects of the mind among all possible aspects of the mind. Contemplation of the Dhammas is you contemplate certain Dhammas among all possible Dhammas. And that is, to me, a very straightforward an easy way of understanding this formula. Again, I'm not saying that there might well be other ways of looking at it, but I think that that is a very likely meaning of this, since it is found in the suttas. And you find also that the agamas actually seem to support that particular interpretation, because they are the agama version of the Anapanasati Sutta actually talks about feelings and feelings in exactly that way. So that is the first one for you, just to come to grips with what is meant to by a body as a body. Because sometimes these explanations of what these things mean become very sort of esoteric. You're supposed to see the body as just itself without the self. But sometimes that is very difficult. It's not clear exactly how you do that, what is meant. But if it just means that you watch the breath within the body or some other aspect, it's not so hard anymore. And how do you do that? Do you abide contemplating the body, a body, in the body, ardent, fully aware and mindful. Now, these factors here are often said to be roughly equivalent to the five indriyas. So the five indriyas, again, of course, are faith, the energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. And ardent, therefore, is basically, the Pali here is atapi, and it's related to this idea of self-mortification, the actual root of the word. So it is like this energetic kind of striving, in a sense. But it's related to virya. And virya, as one of the five faculties, is this energy of the mind, this natural energy of the mind. It's important in the Pali to distinguish between what you might call putting effort into something and having natural energy. The difference is that when you put effort into something, which is like the four right efforts, it means that you are striving. You are applying yourself to the task. You are striving, is coming from inside of you. But the idea of energy is a natural arising energy in the mind. So when you do anapanasati practice, you find that happiness and bliss arises. You find energy arising. It's not because you're applying yourself to anything in particular, or you're just watching the breath. And as you watch the breath, these things happen automatically by themselves. And that is virya.
Because of atapi, virya arises.
No, in this case, I'm saying atapi is most likely a synonym for virya. Yeah, that's what I'm saying here. I'm just explaining. Yeah, it's probably a bit of both. It's not clear exactly what it is. I would say it's a bit of both. But mostly it is synonymous with virya. So what I'm saying here, because once you come to Satipatthana, because you have already, in a sense, finished with the four right efforts, and you're moving on beyond the four right efforts, you actually come to a stage which is so refined that here is mostly energy which is naturally occurring in the mind. It's not so much you applying yourself, it's natural energy. There's probably still a little bit of degree of you applying yourself, but mostly this refers to natural energy. Of course, the very fact that they use a word like atapi rather than virya probably means that it must be slightly different from virya, otherwise they would have used the word virya there. So it's probably slightly broader than that. And then you have fully aware. This is sampajanya in the Pali. And this is something you find in the suttas all the time. You find this compound sati sampajanya, mindfulness and clear awareness, or full awareness. And this idea of sampajanya is usually understood to mean that you know what you are doing. Yeah? And you know, if you have listened to Ajahn Brahm's talks often, you will see how he always talks about when you meditate, there's two things. One is that you are aware of what's happening, you are present, you know what's going on. But there's also the memory of the instructions. In other words, you know what you're doing. You know whether you're going in the right way. You know whether you are practicing the right thing. You know whether things are leading in the right direction. That is the sampajanya, it's the wisdom aspect, which understands that you are doing what you're supposed to be doing, and that you are following the instructions in the right way. And this is the wisdom aspect here. It's a very important part, of course, of Satipatthana, because it tells you whether you are practicing in the right way. And if things start to go wrong, it means that you can correct yourself before it goes completely haywire, so to speak. So there is a wisdom aspect there, and that is what full awareness is. You know what you're doing, you remember the instructions, so that you know that you are going the right way. And the last one here is very interesting, mindful. All of these words here are adjectives that describe the bhikkhu who is doing Satipatthana, right? So because they describe the bhikkhu who is doing Satipatthana, it means that he is mindful already before he starts the practice. And you will see that also if you go to the Anapanasati Sutta, you will see in the Anapanasati Sutta that before he does breath meditation, he sits down and he establishes mindfulness. This is the first thing he does. You can't do Anapanasati properly unless mindfulness is already established. So, because Anapanasati is a species of Satipatthana, you would expect the same thing to be the case for Satipatthana. And indeed it is, because that's what it says right here. You are mindful already when you practice this. So, often I hear the claim that Satipatthana is about becoming more mindful. And of course, again, you do become more mindful by practicing Satipatthana. because you're clarifying the mind, you're abandoning the last hindrances, you're moving to samadhi. So there's some truth to that. But the main point is that you actually have to have established mindfulness mostly beforehand, and then you can purify it a bit more. But the main purpose of satipatthana is not the establishing of mindfulness, it is using the mindfulness you already have to move to samadhi. That's what it's about. And then you have the last one here, which is an interesting one. It's having put away covetousness and grief for the world, which is a rather curious phrasing, to say the least. And the words here behind this are vinaya loke abhidra domanasa, other words here. And vinaya literally means having put away, is fine. Having put away is perfectly acceptable translation. It means having overcome, having put away, having gone beyond, that sort of thing. And for the world is also an acceptable translation, but I'll explain a bit more afterwards what that means. The problem here is covetousness and grief. What does that actually mean in this context? The compound here is abhidra domanasa. Now, that same compound occurs just before, if you look at the Eightfold Path, you go to the four right efforts, and the four right efforts, one of the most important things there is the sense restraint formula. And if you look in the gradual training as well, sense restraint always comes before mindfulness. Mindfulness is a function of sense restraint. It happens because of sense restraint. And that compound exists in the sense restraint formula. And the purpose of that compound in the sense restraint formula is that you restrain the senses so that abhidra and domanasa do not arise in the mind. And of course, sense restraint is about not being attracted or repelled by the contact of the senses. So what these two words really mean, as far as I'm concerned, is the attraction and aversion to the senses. So, and the word world then, because we're talking about the senses, the world then basically means the world of the five senses, the kama loka. And you find that in the suttas, sometimes the word loka, world, is used precisely in that way, to mean the world of the five senses. Just like we might say in English, the word world is very diverse. Sometimes the world, we say the world, we mean humanity. Sometimes we say the world, we mean the earth. Sometimes we say the world, we mean the universe. It has a very broad, can have very broad meanings. And it's exactly the same in Pali. It's almost identical in Pali. It can have very, very broad meanings depending on the context. And here, the context seems to mean basically the five senses, the world, kama loka. That's what seems to be the main meaning here. So, in the sense restraint formula, you put away, or you try to overcome the attraction and aversion that arises in the mind as a consequence of contact with the five senses. That's what sense restraint is about, not allowing the desire and aversion to arise. And then, once you come to satipatthana, because you have already done the four right efforts, you have overcome that attraction and aversion towards the five senses. Not towards other, towards the objects of the five senses. So that's why four right efforts are about overcoming that, and once you get here, you have overcome it. And that's what it says, having put away here. So what this is about is having put away desire and aversion towards the world of the five senses. And you will recognize that this is very close to the first two hindrances of the five hindrances. And Ajahn Brahm likes to say that this is roughly equivalent to the five hindrances, and I think that's roughly right. But I don't think it is quite as strong as having overcome the five hindrances. It's a bit weaker than that, I think. And that reason for that is because the purpose of satipatthana, and that's quite clear in many places, is to overcome refined hindrances in the mind, very subtle hindrances in the mind. And because that is the purpose, I think that what is meant here is that you have put away the coarse hindrances, the medium hindrances, but there are still some very refined ones left in the mind, which have to be overcome through satipatthana practice. So that is the meaning of that particular phrase. So when you come to satipatthana, you already are a very pure person at this point. You are already mindful, and you have fairly clear awareness, and you are energetic. So all of these things come together here. So that is the main kind of how to understand this particular refrain in the Satipatthana Sutta. And then the same thing happens for feelings. It's exactly the same formula again. You contemplate some feelings among all feelings. The mind again, you contemplate the mind. The mind here is important to understand what that means, is that Pali word is citta, and citta can mean either the mind as a whole, or it can mean mind states. So a particular mind state is called a citta. So what that means is that you contemplate certain mind states among all possible mind states. That's what that means, the third satipatthana they have. And the last one, this is the most difficult one of all, to know exactly what is meant. He contemplates dhammas among dhammas. And this is translated here as mind objects. Exactly, I think Ajahn Sujato, in his book, The History of Mindfulness, he argues that what is meant here is basically conditionality, because the Dhamma is a teaching about conditionality. And if you look at those aspects of this particular Satipatthana, you will see that conditionality is a very important part of that, is understanding the conditionality of the mind. But basically, it's about insight practice at this particular point. The last tetrad, as I will show you later on, is essentially about insight practice, whereas the first three ones are largely about samadhi. And it's quite clear when you look at these things later on. So the last one is about insight, and it particularly, I would say, insight into conditionality and causality. That's the main thing here. Very important in Buddhism, because when you understand conditionality and causality, you can start understanding the workings of the mind and the bondage to samsara as well. So there you are. That is the brief formula. It's very important and good to understand what it means, because this brief formula is what you come across in the suttas everywhere. The full exposition of Satipatthana Sutta is only found here in the Digha Nikaya. The brief formula is found again and again and again. It's very handy to know what it means. So now, having done the introduction, now we come to the actual exercises. And the first exercise here is mindfulness of breathing. And this exercise is exactly identical here to how it is explained in the Anapanasati Sutta. There's no difference, except that this only takes into account the first four factors of the 16 factors of mindfulness of breathing here. And of course, the question arises is, was this part of the Satipatthana Sutta originally? You will find that there are so many aspects here to Satipatthana of the body. There's a four posture, there's full awareness, there is the 31 parts of the body, there are the five elements, there are the charnel ground contemplations. So all of these are part of body contemplation here. And the interesting question is, and this is the question that Ajahn Sujato asks, is, well, were all of these actually there from the very beginning, or have some of these been added? And he argues that through comparative study, comparing it to the Chinese, the Agama version, as I said, there's two Agama versions of the sutta, and comparing it to the Vibhanga of the Pali Abhidhamma and also other Abhidhammas, he concludes that the most likely original part of body contemplation is just 31 parts of the body. And that everything else, quite likely, was added later on. And perhaps you think, well, I have just said that Anapanasati is Satipatthana, so why shouldn't Anapanasati be in there? And I would say the reason why it probably shouldn't be in there is because the breath meditation fulfills all four Satipatthanas, not just the first one. Because in Satipatthana Sutta, you get the impression that breath meditation only concerns the body contemplation. But in fact, in the Anapanasati Sutta, the breath contemplation actually concerns all four Satipatthanas, not just the first one. So I think it's quite possible that it is a later addition. Probably some editor said, well, clearly this is part of body contemplation, it should go in there, or, you know, we want to expand it a little bit because it needs, you know. I don't think anybody was trying to be manipulative and actually destroy it, you know, trying to do something wrong. It's just that these things tend to happen when you start to edit things and you start to do things. You try to sort of make an authoritative sutta, so to speak, and you move them around, put them into new collections and all these kind of things. Anyway, I will briefly. I'm not going to go through all of these exercises because, as I said, I think probably the only, quite possibly the only original one is the 31 parts of the body. The other ones are obviously important, but not perhaps so much in the Satipatthana context. But I'll briefly go through mindfulness of breathing as well. Although this should really be done separately under the Anapanasati Sutta. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating the body, a body in the body? Here a bhikkhu, gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, sets his body erect and established mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful, he breathes in. Mindful, he breathes out. So that is just the standard thing, and you will notice here, quite importantly, that when you meditate, you sit down, you fold your legs crosswise, and you go to an empty place, you go far away. In other words, you are secluded. There isn't very much evidence in the suttas of people sitting meditation together. It was usually a solitary thing you did, and this is some of the evidence for that. And as it says here, you sit down, you put your legs crosswise. In other words, meditation was something that you normally did in a sitting position. There's also evidence in the sutta that you did walking meditation. There's also quite a bit of that. But there's very little of standing meditation or lying down meditation. That is not something you really see. It only exists as the four postures. And the four postures are not really, I think, meant as meditation practices. You'll see that afterwards. And then, doing that, you have this whole series of things that you do in Anapanasati. You understand that you breathe in long, you understand that you breathe in short, and you breathe out short. You breathe in, experiencing the whole body, and tranquilizing the body. I'm just going over this quite fast, otherwise we'll be here all night. And the point here is simply that you see he understands that he breathes in long. You are aware that you have a long breath. You understand that you breathe in short. You are aware that you have a short breath. This is not about controlling the breath, it's about knowing the breath. Two very different things. There's no control involved here. Sometimes you hear people say, oh, you're supposed to control the breath. Make it long, make it short. But here it is simply about understanding, knowing whether the breath is long or short. Then you have experiencing the whole body, which comes next here. And again, this word body, kaya, is so diversely used in the suttas. And the commentary explains that experiencing the whole body here means experiencing the whole body of the breath. In other words, you experience the breath from the very beginning to the very end, going in and out. And I think, to me, that is a very sensible understanding, because this is the general understanding of how samadhi progresses. As you go deeper, you see more and more of the breath, until you see the whole breath. This is natural understanding of breath meditation, that you should here suddenly experience the whole physical body. To me, at least, doesn't really make sense. And the next one is tranquilizing the bodily formation. Bodily formation is another word for the breath. So this just means that you are tranquilizing the breath, or rather, you are allowing the breath to tranquilize itself just by watching it. So that is the breath contemplation. I won't go into more detail because, as I said, it's going to take too long otherwise. And then you have it's called here the insight paragraph. And this again shows you the bias of the translator in this particular case, because or perhaps, I'm not sure if it is in the Pali. I don't think there's anything in Pali which says insight. That's probably why it's in parentheses there, because otherwise it wouldn't have been in parentheses. Let's have a quick look, because I think that's quite important. Yeah, there's nothing in the Pali which actually says insight. This is just an addition added by the translator of this book. Yeah. And of course, it's a mixture. Fixed up Nanamoli's original translation. Yeah. I'm not sure who put it in there. I don't know. So this is obviously already gives a slant to the understanding that this is about insight. But when you look at what actually is going on here, it is not clear at all that this is necessarily about insight. So let's have a look at this paragraph. This is an important one. This is a very important part of Satipatthana. It's quite important to go through this in detail again. So let's read through it first of all. In this way, he abides contemplating a body in among bodies internally, or he abides contemplating a body among bodies externally, or he abides contemplating a body among bodies internally and externally. Or else, he abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing. Or else, mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating a body among bodies. So the first thing to note here is that there is like a gradual sequence here. The very first part here, when he starts talking about the body internally, externally, this is normally understood to be samadhi practice. And indeed, if you go to a sutta in the Digha Nikaya, I think it's called the Janavasabha Sutta, you find that this is specifically said to be a samadhi practice. It leads towards samadhi. So in that sense, obviously, it is described specifically in the sutta as a samadhi practice. And so I think it is fairly just this, and of course mindfulness of breathing in its own right is usually a samadhi practice. So I think that first part there, it's quite obvious clearly to do with samadhi. Now the second part here, the arising and vanishing and arising and vanishing, of course this is vipassana, because here you are contemplating impermanence. But what is interesting here, and again this is I take this from Ajahn Sujato's book, because he is the one who has done all these comparative studies, that this, the first part, internally, externally, exists in almost, I think it exists in all versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, whereas the arising and vanishing only exist in less than half the versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. And what that means is that this last part has less, if you like, likelihood of being having been there since the very beginning. And it may have been a later addition to the Satipatthana Sutta. Indeed, if you start to look at how Satipatthana is used, as I mentioned before, throughout the suttas, there is very little evidence that Satipatthana had a general insight part to it, that everything in Satipatthana was about insight. The insight part of Satipatthana comes later on. It does not come with every single exercise. So I think that it is quite possible that Ajahn Sujato might be right, that this may be a later addition. And then the last part here, again, all of this is also much more controversial, because most of these things that come afterwards here are not part of all the versions. So some of this may not be original, some of it may. It's sometimes very, very difficult to have any clarity about what is and what isn't. But you can also see here, which is interesting, of course, is that there is a gradual evolution here. You start off practicing samadhi, then you have the second part, which is the insight part, which you can do after samadhi, and towards the very end, you have this idea of being independent, not clinging to anything in the world. And that, of course, has to do with realization. In particular, it has to do with arahantship, the result of vipassana, of insight practice. So, let me just go in a bit more detail of these things. So you abide contemplating the body, a body among bodies internally. Internally means relating to yourself, to your own body. So here you are looking at the breath, your own breath practice. Externally means other people usually. So it means relating to others. Now you can see it is a little bit strange that you should look at other people's breath. It's not a very natural thing here. You wonder what that can be here. It doesn't make all that much sense. And I would say that could very well be an indicator that the breath meditation actually is not naturally doesn't fit very well into this place. It could be another indicator that it is a later addition to the sutta. So I know that the commentaries to the Pali will, of course, they have an explanation for these things. But I think, to me, it does not look like a natural fit. And then you have internally and externally. And it is interesting, you see this particularly later on when it comes to the contemplation of the body parts. You first you contemplate in relation to yourself, then you contemplate in relation to other people and or other beings, and then you take them together, internally, externally. It's like a universalization, where everything, all beings, you and others, you make no distinction between the two. And you know that universe, it's a universal truth that all beings are like this. They're all constituted of 31 parts of the body. They can all be divided up in this way. So the internal is the most basic one. Then comes the external one, which are other people. And then comes the universalization, everything together. It's a universal truth. Yes?
So it can't be that you kind of like look at the breath, it's like, it's not mine, it's, you know, it's, you know, everybody, you know, everybody, and, you know, all the living beings are breathing, so, you know, it's just, you know, breath.
Yeah, yeah.
So it doesn't mean that one.
It could mean that, but it's somehow, I find it hard, because the breath meditation is something you do it against samadhi usually.
Yeah.
It's not usually an insight practice as such. And I find it as strange that you should start thinking about the breath of other beings.
Yeah.
Usually, if you look at other beings, it would be maybe to do some kind of a asubha practice, you look at the 31 parts or whatever, elements, something like that, but not the breath. It doesn't seem natural to me. Of course, I mean, I'm saying that there are many opinions about this, but that is how it looks to me anyway. Yeah. And then you have the second paragraph about arising and vanishing, and arising and vanishing. Yeah. And this is the Vipassana part, which I said, I think, may very well have been a later addition to the sutta. And then towards the very end here, you have, or else, mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And what this seems to mean is a little bit cryptic. It's not very precisely clear what is meant here. But the point here, this idea of bare knowledge, bare understanding, mindfulness, there is a body, seems to mean that you know that there is this body here, and you don't add anything to it. You don't add a sense of self. You don't add a sense of beauty. You don't add a sense of permanence. In other words, you understand it for what it is. It's a bare knowledge without any addition to that. And of course, this is the kind of thing that the street mentor has. The street mentor has this ability to see the body in this way. For Putujanas, it's sometimes difficult. If you do have very deep samadhi, you might be able to see the body in this way. But for most Putujanas, it is almost impossible to have that full understanding of the body. So I take this most likely to be a reference either to somebody who has deep samadhi, and certainly a reference to somebody who is a stream mentor. You're able to see it exactly for what it is. It's the bare knowledge and mindfulness. And then the last one, he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. And here we are talking about the arahant, not clinging to anything in the world. This quite clearly refers to arahantship. So you can see here, the process here is very clearly that this paragraph here is a process going on. You have the samadhi, then you have the insight, and then you have the results of the insight coming last, the stream entry, and then arahantship. And this, in this sense, the paragraph makes good sense, because there's a natural flow here to the way it goes. So that is the that paragraph there, and I think labeling the paragraph as insight is misleading. Yeah. It is not. Gives a wrong impression, and it shows you how easy it is for an editor or redactor to make mistakes. And of course, everybody makes mistakes. Everybody is bound to make mistakes, and that's why it's so dangerous to write anything, because as soon as you write something, there's bound to be something in there which is completely wrong, and you go the wrong way. So I'm not really criticizing anybody here, but because this is just the nature of the game, that you're going to make mistakes. So, that is that one. The next one here is the four postures, and then comes full awareness. And I'm not going to go into this in detail, because as I said before, I think it's quite likely that these are not original parts of Satipatthana. They are certainly parts of the Dhamma, the important aspects of Dhamma, but they are more like preliminary things that come prior to Satipatthana practice proper. And of course, here you have the four postures, which are standing, sitting, lying, and walking. And you are aware that you have those four postures. But it's not really called a meditation exercise in the ordinary sense anywhere in the sutta. So then you have the full awareness here. And the full awareness is quite interesting. You look at the full awareness you're supposed to have, this full awareness of stretching and bending your limbs and wearing the robes and carrying your robe and bowl and eating, drinking, consuming food, tasting, defecating, urinating, standing, walking, sitting. Then you have falling asleep. Actually, the Pali here is not falling asleep. It's asleep. Sutte means literally asleep. And it's an interesting thing. What is actually meant here? This paragraph on full awareness and I is not the same thing as sati, being mindful. So I think the meaning here is simply that you have full awareness regarding sleep. You know the right amount of sleep. You know when to sleep, the appropriate time and all these kind of things. You have full awareness of your sleeping habits, so to speak. That is what I think it might mean. Or it might mean that you have a peaceful kind of sleep where you don't have all sorts of strange kind of dreaming going on, but you have a peaceful and deep sleep, and when you wake up, you're nice and refreshed. But I think the former explanation is more likely. But falling asleep, there's a different word for that in the Pali. And I don't think, for that reason, I don't think this can mean falling asleep. It actually does mean asleep. Anyway, I won't go into that anymore because I don't think that's maybe possibly not part of the original Satipatthana Sutta. And now we come to the one exercise which probably is the most original and the most important of the Satipatthana on the body. And this is here called foulness. I'm not sure if I like that idea of foulness, but anyway, we shall see what's happening here as I go through this. So again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this same body from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin, as full of many kinds of impurities. Thus, in this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends, full of many sorts of grain, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus: this is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, these are peas, etc., etc. So too, the bhikkhu reviews this same body as full of many kinds of impurities. Thus, in this body there are head hairs, etc., etc., and urine. So this is the body contemplation. And, of course, the point here, you can see that it's a very kind of complete description of a human body. It has all the kind of aspects there. It doesn't leave anything out. And it looks at the body for what it actually is. It doesn't try to hide what the body is all about. And that is, of course, the point here, to actually see the body for what it is. That's why you have things like the contents of the stomach in there, or snot, things that we don't usually feel very attached to, because they're not considered very attractive. And of course, the point here, the main point with this sort of reflection, we are still here on the very first part of Satipatthana, is to help you overcome attraction to the body. Because attraction to the body is so strongly ingrained in us as human beings. So I think sometimes you talk about foulness of the body, but it's more about having a realistic perspective on the body, I think, is more appropriate here. It's to get away from the attraction. It's not to get repelled, a sense of repulsion towards the body, but to neutralize the attraction and get a realistic perspective what this body actually is all about. That is the point here. So, for example, when it says here that there are many kinds of impurities, the Pali word for impurity is asuci. Suci means pure. But the a prefix, which is a negation prefix, often just means non-pure, or lack of purity, or not that it isn't pure. Not necessarily the exact opposite, but a lack of that purity or beauty in the body. So the purpose here, I think, is simply to take away the attraction to the body. And you will see that when it comes to the simile here, it compares the body to a sack full of all kinds of grains and beans and all kinds of things. But all of these things are neutral, right? There's nothing, a grain is just a grain. It's neither beautiful nor ugly. And in the same way that the bag of grains is full of all these kind of things, in the same way the body is all full of all these kind of things, neither beautiful nor ugly. They are just the kind of things that you find in the body. They are just there. This is the way it is. This is the nature of the body. And you will also see here that what this paragraph says, it says that in this body there are. And in this body, in the Pali, is imang eva kayang. I think it's ayang, yeah, imang eva kayang, which means literally this very body. It's referring to the physical body. When it says imang eva kayang, the body, it means the physical body, this very body. So, and of course, when you say this very body, it refers to your body. So when you do this kind of exercise, it's always towards your own body, first of all. That is what it refers to here. And this is like a very general principle in the sutta, that as long as you have attraction to your own body and to yourself, then you will also have attraction to others. By being able to reduce the attraction to your own body, then you also reduce the attraction to other bodies and other people. And I remember there's a sutta I read out last year here, a sutta about why it is that men are attracted to women and women attracted to men. And the interesting thing there, what that sutta said, basically it's because you're attracted to yourself and your own gender. That's why you are attracted to the opposite gender. If you do not take delight in your own gender, in your masculinity, whatever it is, then you will also not take delight in the opposite gender. And that's why the first thing is to overcome that attachment to yourself and to your own body, and then the other attachment fall away as a matter of course, as a consequence of that. So these are the important things here. And you can see that we are still here dealing with fairly gross defilements, overcoming the attachment to the body. And that's why this is the first of the four satipatthanas. Always remember that almost everything in the suttas is gradual. It's very rare that something is not gradual. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, it's the same thing. The first exercise, the body contemplation, is the coarsest one, the most, the first one you need to go through. And then as you go through them, it becomes more and more refined. So, and then of course you have again the same refrain, if you like, at the bottom here. He abides contemplating a body in the body, internally, externally, both internally and externally. And here it makes very good sense. Internally means in relation to you, you contemplate the body. Then once you have, then after having done that, you extend it also to other people. And finally, you universalize it and you have it both internally and externally together, which means it becomes a universal truth of all bodies. So that is the contemplation of the body parts. Then, okay. So I'm going to go much faster now. We've done the kind of the most important things. So then comes the five elements. And this, again, is probably the second most likely part of this body contemplation to be original, because it exists in almost all the different versions except for one or two. And again, the idea here is very similar to the 32 parts of the body. That you look at the body in terms of the constituents of the air factor in the body, the fluid factor in the body, the solidity and the heat element. And by understanding that these elements in the body are the same as elements in the rest of the world, the body is not different really from the elements outside. You see it as the same, and you can, in that sense, you can abandon some attachment to the body. And then you have the famous funeral contemplations, which are contemplations of how the body disintegrates after death. And again, the idea, of course, is to help you overcome the attachment to the body. And the funeral contemplations are also found elsewhere, but they are not a very common contemplation in the suttas. They are relatively more rare than the other ones. So then we come to the contemplation of feeling, the second satipatthana, on the bottom of page 149. And I will read through this one here. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating a feeling among feelings? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, a bhikkhu understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I feel a painful feeling. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel the worldly pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly painful feeling. When feeling an unworldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly painful feeling. When feeling a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So here, essentially, this is obviously about the understanding of feelings and understanding what feelings are about. And you can see here, it spans a large span of different types of feelings, from worldly unpleasant feeling, these are the kind of negative experiences you have through the five senses, all the way up to unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feelings, which essentially are the feelings you experience in very deep states of samadhi, such as the fourth jhana. So all of this are encompassed here. And when it says that you're supposed to understand these things, remember what that means. It doesn't mean just being aware of these things. It means understanding the full scope of these feelings. That's when you actually understand them. Understand them completely, the whole scope. So when it says, understanding a worldly pleasant feeling, it means understanding the whole gamut of feelings based on the five senses. These are the worldly. These are called the samisa, literally with the flesh. These are the worldly pleasant feelings. The unworldly ones are the jhanas and the samadhi feelings. So the way you do that is by understanding this whole gamut of worldly feelings. You know what they are. You know where they extend. You know the gross ones. You know the refined ones. And as you get deeper and deeper in meditation, you leave behind more and more of those worldly feelings. As you leave them behind, you come to understand them more and more, and you understand the refined aspects of those feelings more and more. It's only when your meditation starts to deepen that you can understand the most refined aspects of, like, worldly pleasant feelings, for example. Where are those attachments, last attachments to the body, last attachments to whatever it is in the world of the five senses? So in a sense, all of these things can only be understood once they have been abandoned. And this is one of those things that Ajahn Brahm always makes an important point of. It's just like the famous simile that he always uses about the toad in the water. The toad can only understand water once it becomes a frog and gets out of the water. Then it knows what water is. And it's exactly the same thing here with these feelings. You can only understand fully these pleasant worldly feelings once you remove yourself completely out of them. And this happens, of course, when you start to go into deep states of samadhi. So to understand these things fully, you have to get there. And of course, but on the way, as your meditation deepens, you gradually, you get a deeper and deeper understanding of these things. And if you go again to the Anapanasati Sutta, the Anapanasati Sutta is about how you understand the feelings as you do the breath meditation. And of course, as you do the breath meditation, you go through stages of piti and sukha. And that is what, according to the Anapanasati Sutta, is the meditation on feeling, the satipatthana on feeling, is the understanding, or seeing those feelings as they arise in the Anapanasati. So this is probably one of the main aspects of understanding feelings, is you sit, watch your breath, and you see the feelings arise as you watch the breath. That is understanding feeling in satipatthana. It's the main aspect of it. And then it goes all the way up to the fourth jhana. And only then have you really fully comprehended all the feelings that are part of this understanding of feeling. Now, one of the things that you will notice here, which is quite interesting, is that to practice Satipatthana fully, it actually includes the jhanas, because these amisa or niramisa vedana, these are the unworldly vedanas, these are defined elsewhere as the feelings in jhanas. So Satipatthana explicitly includes jhanas in them. So the full contemplation of Satipatthana includes contemplation of jhana states. So that is a fairly quick overview of the contemplation of feelings. I will go on to the contemplation of mind next. And it goes as follows. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating a particular state of mind among all states of mind? Here a bhikkhu understands a mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust, a mind unaffected by lust as mind unaffected by lust. He understands mind affected by hate as mind affected by hate, and mind unaffected by hate as mind unaffected by hate. He understands mind affected by delusion as mind affected by delusion, and mind unaffected by delusion as mind unaffected by delusion. He understands contracted mind as contracted, distracted mind as distracted. He understands exalted mind as exalted, unexalted mind as unexalted. He understands surpassed mind as surpassed, unsurpassed mind as unsurpassed. He understands concentrated mind as concentrated, and unconcentrated mind as unconcentrated. He understands liberated mind as liberated, and unliberated mind as unliberated. So again, you can see here how the idea here is to understand and to know your own mind. And this is knowing, basically, all these defilements and also knowing the higher states of the mind. You will again notice that many of the words towards the bottom here, like liberated, for example, is a synonym for usually the liberation is what is meant here, is the liberation you have in samadhi. So this again is a synonym for the jhanas, where the mind is liberated from all those other things. And also, some of these other terms here also point in that direction, like the unsurpassed mind, for example, or the concentrated mind, or the exalted mind, all point towards states of deep samadhi. So again, samadhi contemplation is part and parcel of Satipatthana practice at its deepest level. It leads to samadhi, and beyond samadhi, it is part and parcel. It takes into account the contemplation of samadhi itself. And again here, you have the beginning here, you have understanding the mind affected by lust or by hate and by delusion. Again, this is not simply just a matter of knowing when you're angry. Of course, we all know when we're angry. It's about understanding all aspects of anger to the very, very last, most minute irritation, most minute problem. It's understanding the full aspect of this. And again, really the only way you can understand that is when you overcome anger completely. Absolutely, there's no anger in your mind, you just have a sense of compassion and kindness to all beings. That is when you have a full understanding of anger. The same thing with lust, the same thing with delusion. It's only when you overcome these things that you can have a full understanding. So again, it's about very broad here understanding, a universal understanding of these states of mind. As you go deeper in meditation, gradually, your understanding would increase. Then there is the contracted mind and the distracted mind. The contracted mind is usually the mind of sloth and torpor, when it feels like you have imprisoned almost inside of yourself. And the distracted mind is, of course, the restless mind. So here you have the other two hindrances as well. The only hindrance missing here is the hindrance of doubt. So all of these things is good to understand. Once you understand them, there is a hope that you can overcome them. If you don't really understand them, it is much more difficult, obviously. Basically, you can't overcome them unless you understand these things. So, that is the contemplation of the mind. Anybody have everybody happy with that one? Yeah. Then we come to the last of the four Satipatthanas. I'm going to go through this one quite quickly. These are the contemplation of the mind objects, in which I think I said before, this relates much more here. We are coming into insight practice proper. And the reason why this is about insight, and you can be quite sure about that, is because you will see when we go through this that it is all about conditionality, about understanding things. That's what this is all about. And if you go to the Anapanasati Sutta, you will see in the Anapanasati Sutta that up to this point, it's all about making the mind more peaceful, until you get to step 12 in the Anapanasati Sutta, which is the Mochayam Chittan, freeing the mind. And of course that, again, is a term for jhana, for deep samadhi. And after that step, the the last four stages of Anapanasati are about insight, very clearly, because it talks about anicca, viraga, nirodha, and patanissaga, and these are like insight practices. So here we are coming into insight, the plane of insight proper. But as you will have seen, as we have gone through this, we have already, in a sense, gone through, come to a very deep state of samadhi prior to starting this insight practice. And that fits very well with how the suttas always talk about these things. They always say that yata bhuta jnanadasana, seeing things as they actually are, which is really vipassana, always comes after samadhi in the suttas. That's when it comes. So that is when you can have real vipassana, after samadhi. Beforehand, it is the question of whether you can have vipassana before that really depends on how you define the word vipassana. And it can perhaps be said that you can have some vipassana then, because you can contemplate impermanence and you can see to some extent. But the real vipassana, the yathabhuta jnanadasana, the seeing things as they actually are, can only happen after samadhi. Before that, you're going to be deluded to some extent. Yes, Nicholas. Yes, they are mind objects. And that's why I say that the dhammas are not mind objects, as I understand it. This is about vipassana and conditionality here. And whereas the paragraph contemplation of the mind, in my opinion, is has more to do with mind objects. Or I would call it states of mind, actually, rather than mind objects. Understanding states of mind. Yeah. No, I don't think so, because I think mind objects is not actually mind objects. It's actually about understanding conditionality here. It's Dhamma in the sense of understanding the Dhamma as a... it's like dependent origination is understanding the Dhamma. Once you break through dependent origination, you understand Dhamma. What you're understanding with dependent origination is causality. You understand how things are caused. And this whole part here is about causality here. So I think it's about Dhamma in the sense of a system of causality. Buddhism is about understanding causality, basically. Everything is caused. Everything comes into being because of something else. It's the opposite of having a sense of self. A sense of self implies non-causality. It's something which stands as a rock, independent of everything else. So causality is like one thing, Buddhism. Sense of self is the opposite. It's like the something which is permanent and always stays there. Yeah. Okay, so here we come to the mind objects. And again, if I'm going to follow Adam Sujato, he argues in his book that basically the two most likely original contemplations of Dhamma here are the five hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment, and possibly the six sense bases, whereas the Four Noble Truths and the five aggregates exist in only one or two of the different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. So they're very, very unlikely to have been original. Indeed, if you look at the suttas, there's almost nowhere, I think actually nowhere, are the five aggregates mentioned as a Satipatthana practice, apart from this particular sutta and the equivalent sutta in the Digha Nikaya. And the same thing is true, I believe, of the Four Noble Truths. So this is how the Satipatthana of the five hindrances is explained. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating Dhammas, a Dhamma among Dhammas? Here a bhikkhu abides contemplating a Dhamma as a Dhamma in terms of the five hindrances. And how does a bhikkhu abide doing this? Here, when there is sensual desire in him, he understands there is sensual desire in me. Or, there being no sensual desire in him, he understands there is no sensual desire in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire, how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. So this is all about conditionality, because this is about, well, first of all, it's about understanding what these things are. And again, to be able to understand whether there is sensual desire inside of you, the only way you can do that is to go beyond sensual desires. You have seen sensual desire in all its various forms, even to the most refined state. Just like the most minute kind of desire for comfort in the body or whatever it is, or interest in hearing or whatever it is. So again, you have to go beyond to understand what is happening here. Then you can understand the whole spectrum of sensuality, what it is. And then you have, so the only way you can actually understand this is by going beyond. And this again implies samadhi. Only then can you have that full understanding. And of course, the understanding that there is no sensual desire is just the reverse, the opposite of that. They go together. You understand how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire. Now, again, this is something, all of these things, it's fine to say these things in theory. Of course, the best, far, far more important is to see these things in your own practice, in your own mind. That's when it really works. So, of course, that is what we really want to do. But in the suttas, it does explain also how sensual desire comes to arise. How does it come to arise? When you give unwise attention to what is called, like what you consider a beautiful object. When you give unwise attention to a beautiful object, that is how desire arises, sensual desire arises in the mind. So, that is of course very important. It's only when that happens you see it arising that there's a problem there.
Is unwise attention when you don't consider the nature of that object, but you sort of see the fixed beauty or beautiful or whatever, but don't sort of see something else change?
Any attention which gives rise to sensual desire is unwise. So if you are seeing something that gives rise to desire, you know straight away it must be unwise attention. So obviously you are thinking about its beauty. You're seeing the beauty in something which is not necessarily beautiful. You are, you know, forgetting that. Of course, the sort of thing that you do here, and of course, the main thing often is just always, like, you know, the opposite gender tends to be the main problem. So you remind yourself, you know, of aging, of old age. Remind yourself of the 32 parts of the body. You remind yourself, sometimes the suttas talk about having, like, you know, the sister perception of somebody, or the mother perception, or daughter perception, because that also has a kind of neutralizing feeling. So all of these things are there to sort of help you overcome this. So whatever perception gives rise to desire is a perception that is unwise according to this. So you just have to be clear in your mind what's happening here. Okay, so that is how it arises, by giving wrong attention to what you consider a beautiful object. And of course, the way that it disappears, the way you get rid of that, the way it is abandoned, is by not attending in that way anymore. Not attending to the beautiful aspect of something. So instead attending, bringing up the perception that you have been building up over time, the perception of 32 parts or whatever, and you bring that up to counteract the other one. Or you, hopefully you bring it up before anything happens, so that you don't have the desire arising in the first place. That's the ideal thing. That is of course what is called sense restraint. To be able to do that, you have to understand the dukkha of sensual desire. It's only when you have some understanding of the dukkha, of the negative consequences, that it is possible to practice in this way. If you think that there is happiness there, it's almost impossible to avoid going, so to speak, going after that and actually allowing desire to arise. So that's why it is so important to contemplate the suffering in these things. Because once the contemplation of suffering has gone very deeply, it is possible to very quickly turn your attention in a different direction, because it's already established in you that there is an aspect of suffering here. And then, and the last one is how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. And here, of course, we're talking about very high dhammas. Here we're talking about things like the Arya stages. And this is, essentially, this is the kind of the Sotapanna's insight, knowing that if he practices the Noble Eightfold Path, it will eventually lead to the complete eradication of sensual desire. It's an Aryan insight we're talking about here. So here we are So this is, you can see again, there's a gradation here. First you have to understand the desire, then you have to understand how it is arisen and abandoned, and finally how the final abandoning comes to happen. So again, the gradation of the sutta is a very important aspect here again. Then you have exactly the same system for the other four hindrances. And of course, again, you have to understand each of the four hindrances as fully as possible in all its manifestation, particularly the subtle manifestations. And you have to understand why they arise. And ill will arises because of wrong attention to something which is unpleasant. It's called the patiga in Pali. It means like something which repels you, or something you feel a sense of resistance towards. You resist it. That's why ill will arises. And again, you have to look out for that. Look out for the... you have to, you know, do metta practice to overcome that aspect, basically. Because when you see the positive qualities in somebody, then of course that ill will, that negativity, will not be allowed to arise. So that is the same thing all the way down. With sloth and torpor and restlessness and remorse, you have to be a bit more... It's a bit different, but generally speaking, if you are able to overcome ill will and sensual desire, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse will also be largely abandoned. But again, here you have to look at the causes for these things. And lastly, there is doubt. And you understand doubt in exactly the same way. And the reason why doubt is said to arise in the sutta is because of unwise attention to things that are doubtful. So you look at things and you doubt too much and you think too much about it in the wrong kind of way, and that is why it arises. Is that really all it says in the suttas about that? So that is the five hindrances. And you will see here, it's interesting, then you have the paragraph afterwards which is called insight again, which comes on the next page. And the strange thing here is that we have just been talking about the arising of the five hindrances. What causes the arising? What causes the abandonment? And then suddenly here, on this next page, you have the standard refrain on insight, which talks about you contemplate these things in terms of their arising and their vanishing, etc. It again, it seems like you have a doubling up here. It doesn't seem to be required, because it's already been said in the sutta. And that could be, again, you know, you have to be open-minded about these things, but it could be, it's possible that means that, you know, it could be an indication that this paragraph here is not really supposed to be there, as I mentioned before. Then you have the five aggregates coming next, in terms of contemplation of dhammas. Now the five aggregates, quite clearly, in my opinion, don't really belong here. The five aggregate contemplation is the kind of contemplation you do just before you become enlightened in the suttas. It's a very profound thing. It's never really called satipatthana anywhere. Then you have the six bases. These are the six sense bases. And this possibly goes a long way back because it is found in many of the Satipatthana suttas. But I won't get into it now because it's just taking too much time. And then you have the seven enlightenment factors. And I want to go through those quickly because they are seem to be a very ancient part of this particular sutta. So it says here, again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating dhammas, a dhamma among dhammas, in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating dhammas among dhammas, in terms of the seven enlightenment factors? Here, there being the mindfulness enlightenment factor in him, the bhikkhu understands that is the mindfulness enlightenment factor in me. And there being no mindfulness and enlightenment factor in him, he understands there is no mindfulness enlightenment factor in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness enlightenment factor, and how the arisen mindfulness enlightenment factor comes to fulfillment and development. And then you have the same formula for the other six factors of enlightenment. And again, you will see here, the bhikkhu knows that the mindfulness enlightenment factor is in me. Now what does that mean to know that? And I think the bare minimum here for having the mindfulness factor is the type of mindfulness that you have when you start the Satipatthana practice. It's the type of mindfulness you have when the mind is restrained, is not running out into the world of the five senses here and there with desire and aversion. is the mindfulness of a kind of clarity of the mind, which is quite peaceful, that you can use for meditation practice proper. That is basically what is meant here. In other words, a mind which is already very pure, there might be some very small hindrances left, but hardly any hindrances left there. In other words, the type of mind that I was discussing before, that you have when you start the Satipatthana practice. But of course, to understand the mindfulness fully, again, that you have to see the development of mindfulness. And mindfulness develops as you go through the samadhi stages, and it develops all the way till you get to the fourth jhana. And that is where mindfulness is fully established to the maximum. So again, you can only have a full understanding of this enlightenment factor when you get to the fourth jhana. That's when the full understanding arises. So this is what it means, that you know it is present, and then you know that it's not present. And you know it's arising. You know how mindfulness arises in you. You understand how the Noble Eightfold Path, how restraint leads to mindfulness, how virtue leads to mindfulness, etc., etc. And you understand the fulfillment of that factor by development. In other words, basically going to the fourth jhana is what is meant here. Then you have the second factor of the bhojangas, the factors of enlightenment, which are the investigation of states. Now again, I have to again tell you one more time that this is about, there's a conditionality going in here, there is a sequence going in here, on here. It is not as if the seven factors of enlightenment are completely separate and independent. They build on each other. So you start off with mindfulness, that leads on to the investigation of states, which leads on to energy, which leads on to piti, tranquility, samadhi and upekkha eventually. This is again, there's a sequence happening here. So investigation of states in the seven bhujangas is defined as, most importantly, as understanding what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. What is kusala, what is akusala, it's also what is dark, what is bright, what is blameworthy and unblameworthy. So you understand that distinction. And of course, if you are going to progress in your meditation, this is very important to be able to know what is a wholesome quality and what is an unwholesome quality. A lot of what we have been talking about already has been about that. And this is just reaffirming that importance to understand the difference. And this, of course, it goes up to the abandoning of the five hindrances. You know that all the hindrances are bad qualities and the abandoning is the good qualities, but it goes beyond that. And that is what is so interesting. And actually, once you go even higher into samadhi, you know that the qualities of the highest states of samadhi are superior to the qualities of lowest states of samadhi. So again, this is a relative thing. The higher you go, the more pure those states and those wholesome qualities are. So again, this becomes completed or reaches this culmination when you attain the fourth jhana. And from investigation of states, you get energy here. Energy arises because you are investigating, you are understanding the Dhamma. There is also another way of investigating here. That other way of investigating is investigating the suttas, or the teaching of the Buddha. There are two complementary ways of investigating. And both of them, when that understanding arises, it leads to the sense of energy inside of you. Just as when you're meditating, you get energy and piti. Here too, you get energy and piti. It's the natural energy that arises inside of you. This is not about exerting yourself or pushing yourself. It is a natural energy that comes from investigation and from the right way of practicing. And that's why the next factor is the rapture, the piti, usually comes together with that energy. Then you get the tranquility. Tranquility is a function. It comes always after rapture in the sutta. This is like the natural sequence of how the mind develops in samadhi. From piti comes tranquility. From tranquility then comes concentration. And the height of concentration is the equanimity, which is the last of the seven factors of enlightenment. And that equanimity, of course, is perfected again in the fourth jhana. So you see the gradualness here. You start off with just mindfulness and you end up gradually by stage in the fourth jhana. These are the seven factors of enlightenment.
What do you mean by it perfected?
You do, because it's, all of these factors are developed as you go through, and they increase as you go through the path. And already in the third jhana, upekka is very powerful. It's actually called upekka sukha. The happiness of equanimity is called in the third jhana. But in the fourth jhana, it's pure upekka, just pure, nothing else. That's why it's purified completely. Yeah. Devoid of any kind of happiness or suffering. So you go through this gradual thing. You understand all of these factors in terms of what they are. And only when you come to the fourth jhana do you have a full understanding of what they are, what they are not. And of course, you understand how they arise. They arise basically through this sequence. And you understand how they come to fulfillment by development through the practice of the Noble Eightfold Path, eventually leading to arahatship. So this is what it's about. And you will see here that one of the interesting things here, of course, is that the seven factors of enlightenment are basically samadhi factors. It's all about getting into the jhanas. Ideally, you want to get to the fourth jhana. And this is the basis on which enlightenment is possible. It doesn't say much here about insight. Of course, insight is implied, because insight is part and parcel of this. But I think the main point is that if you do practice these seven factors of enlightenment, if you do get into deep samadhi, then insight happens as a matter of course. That is why it says in the suttas, if you do get samadhi, you don't have to wish for or demand or strive for yatha bhuta nanadasana, seeing things as they actually are. It comes as a natural consequence of samadhi that you see things as they actually are. It's one of those fascinating things that the seven factors of enlightenment are based around samadhi. The Noble Eightfold Path ends in samadhi. There isn't that much talk about any kind of vipassana at that point. Samadhi is what is most important. And the reason is, because I think, is basically because as you practice in this way, the vipassana, the insight, happens as a function of that practice. Anyway, so that is the fourth factor of satipatthana, and you see it has a lot to do with insight at this stage. Even though I have said it has a lot to do with samadhi, it has a lot to do with insight, because it also has to do with the insight into how these things come into being. And as always, insight and samadhi goes together. But the final, the deep insight, happens as a function of all these things coming together. Did that make sense? I'm not sure if I made any sense there, but happy with that? Yeah? Okay. I'll just quickly go through the conclusion here, the very last part. And here, of course, we come to what happens if you practice these four foundations or four focuses of mindfulness. Because if anyone should develop these four focuses of mindfulness in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected for him. Either final knowledge here and now, which is arahatship, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-returning. Let alone 7 years, if one should do it for 6 years, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 year, two fruits can be expected. If you do it for 7 months, 6, 5, 4, 3, down to 1 month, and all the way down to 7 days, one of two fruits can be expected, either arahantship or non-returning. So here you have this paragraph which tells you if you practice these things properly, you will attain some of these things. Whether this passage here is original to the sutta or not, again, is controversial. It's not found in all of the different versions. And you will find there's some interesting little things when you read this passage here carefully. There's some interesting little things here. For example, you will notice that it starts off with 7. The number 7 is very prominent here. It starts off, if you do it for 7 years, why 7 years? Why not 5 or 10, which is like a round number? Why does it start with 7? And then it goes down to 1 year. And when it gets to 1 year, it jumps from 1 year to 7 months. It doesn't, if it forgets about the 11, the 10, and the 9, it goes to 7, right? And then when it comes down to 1 month, it goes on to 7 days. So the number 7 is very prominent here. And the point is that some people have mentioned is that the number 7 has like a mythological or legendary significance in most societies. So by putting the number 7 in there, you're kind of imbuing this with almost like a mythological and legendary feel to it. So, you know, And that, to me, might be, I don't know, I'm not sure about this, but it might be a sign of a kind of a later addition, because you are giving, it's like when you give something a legendary or mythological aspect, it's like you give it an emotional aspect, because legend and myth is all about emotion, but getting your emotions in there and getting a feeling for this whole thing called Satipatthana. So, of course, I'm not saying this is wrong or anything, I'm just saying that it is a little bit interesting how that actually sequence works there.
Ajahn, don't we have the same thing?
No, it doesn't. It's only exist here, and I think one other place, which is about the eight precepts or something like that. It's a quite, very different kind of thing here. So it's quite a strange thing here. But in any case, of course, it says here that you can become fully enlightened by practicing in 7 days. Obviously, that assumes that you have already done a lot of work already before you get to that point. So, finally, so it was with reference to this that it was said, because this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four focuses of mindfulness. This is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, any complaints, questions? We don't have, yeah? Yeah. Mm. Well, the thing is, there are many things here. I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. So there are many aspects. The first aspect is that the Devadatta in the suttas is actually quite a marginal figure here. And a lot of the things that you hear about Devadatta is often found in commentaries and all kinds of things. The information about him is not all that trustworthy. Whether he had all the four jhanas and psychic powers and all that is a little bit uncertain. But anyway, let's put that aside. Let's assume that he had all those things. The point is that you can have all the jhanas, and it's true that you have Yathabhuta Nanadasana, but the point is you have to have Yathabhuta Nanadasana again and again and again, and gradually it grows until eventually you make the breakthrough. It doesn't happen straight away, and the reason for that is simply that you have Yathabhuta Nanadasana towards those things that you are focusing on at that time, but over time you need to broaden your focus to incorporate enough of the world to actually make the breakthrough whereby you become a stream enter or whatever. So what you are looking at, you are seeing correctly after the jhana, but you haven't looked enough yet. You haven't looked at enough things to make that generalization of all things being impermanent and being non-self. So although you're seeing correctly, you need to do it a lot before it actually happens. Yeah, and that doesn't happen. It takes still quite a lot of practice. So it is a process. But of course, the more you have know about the suttas, the more understanding you have beforehand, the more likely you are to direct your mind correctly after the jhana, and it then happens in the right way. Yeah. Well, a lot of it, you know, I mean, one of the... Yeah, please, yeah. 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 Well, the thing is that, you know, this is kind of the story which people love to hear, you know. It's entertaining, it's like interesting, it shows the Buddha, you know, and it's kind of thing which people like. It's like Angulimala, people love stories like that. And it's good because it makes it more interesting. It makes it kind of more, it gets you involved in the Dhamma. But the point is, if you look at the suttas, there are different like ways of stratifying the suttas. And the most foundational aspect of the suttas is actually the word of the Buddha. Less foundational is the narrative. The narrative is all the stories around that. The narrative wasn't spoken by the Buddha. It was spoken by somebody else. Nobody knows where that came from. It's been added to the sutta, but nobody knows where it came from. Because you don't know where it came from, it has more uncertainty to it, uncertainty to it than the word of the Buddha itself. Somebody else has said it. Somebody else has made it up. Maybe a long time after the event. And most of the things that you find about Buddha Devadatta, I'm getting tired now, Devadatta is narrative stuff. Stories which came after the Buddha. Very, very little has actually been said by the Buddha himself about these things. And that's why I'm saying it is uncertain. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying it's uncertain. Two different things. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the stuff in there is taken from the commentaries, is taken from all kinds of sources, because they want to fill in the life stories. If you want to fill in the life stories, you have to take lots of different sources. So yes, you have to take it with a pinch of salt. But it doesn't matter, it's still inspiring, and it could be true. Many of these things could be true. And when you read about some of the disciples in the suttas, it's still very inspiring, because some of them obviously were very, very wise. And I actually prefer, when I read a sutta like Venerable Sariputta, for example, giving a discourse, some of the most inspiring things are just the discourses he gives, because there's some beautiful, very beautiful teachings there, you know. To me, that is more inspiring than reading about flying through the air or that sort of stuff, which might be possible, but it's really quite irrelevant as far as I'm concerned for the Dhamma as such. Yeah. Okay. Everybody exhausted? Yeah? Okay, time to go.
Let us express our approval of this Dhamma teaching.
Sadhu, sadhu.